They were grateful the only lasting effect of the war on John was nightmares. When he went through a difficult time, thrashing around in their bed, sometimes knocking over a table lamp, occasionally sleeping on the floor to avoid hitting Peggy as he flailed out at the dark memories, she was always there to comfort him, to remind him just by her presence that they would get through this together. John says, "The war helped me love Peggy more, if that's possible, to appreciate her more." John went back to his old job as a salesman for an import-export firm. Peggy had saved some money from her teaching job during the war. They couldn't find an apartment in their family neighborhood, so they bought a home on Long Island, thus becoming part of a fundamental alteration of American life, the rise of the suburbs, and the subsequent diffusion of the family. They raised a family, two sons. Their firstborn, John Jr., a schoolteacher, died of cancer a few years ago, and they have established a scholarship in his name. Another son, Rich, is a production manager with NBC Sports. John and Peggy are proponents of women's liberation, but they worry that in trying to have it all, a career, marriage, and children, too many young women put their careers ahead of their families. Peggy, who had been a schoolteacher during the war, resumed teaching once the boys were in school themselves. She worries the morals have changed tremendously. The way you're told to raise your kids now, there's no discipline. Divorce is another issue they worry about. Peggy says young couples these days don't fight long enough. It's too easy to get a divorce. We've had our arguments, but we don't give up. When my friends ask whether I ever consider a divorce, I remind them of the old saying, "We thought about killing each other, but divorce? Never." John and Peggy Asensio are not unique within their generation. They can look back on a love affair that began in the Great Depression, was consummated at the outset of World War II, survived combat and separation, and flourished in the post-war years. They were just 21 and 23 when they were married, and they could not have imagined what strains the world would put on their commitment to each other. But they believed their wedding vows were not conditional. Now, in their 57th year of marriage, that belief has not been diminished for John and Peggy. If anything, it has been strengthened by John's recurring memories of the horrors of combat. They come to him less often now, but Peggy is always there for him. As he says, "I relive it sometimes, but with the help of my wife and the love she has for me." That's how you get over it. Such marriages and values may seem curiously old-fashioned to modern young couples. They may have a difficult time relating to a love affair forged by sacrifice and separation, faith and commitment. They may not know how to measure the tensile strength such marriages bring to a society. In an age of divorce, pagers, cell phones, and fax machines, they may never know the sweet sound of a love whistle. One of my favorite pictures from the World War II era is of Jimmy Stewart with his right hand raised, standing with a group of ordinary young Americans being sworn into the Army Air Corps. It was everyone's war, from the impoverished North Dakota farm kid to the pedigreed Ivy Leaguer, the Hollywood star, the sons of the rich and powerful. Theodore Roosevelt Jr. landed in Normandy on D-Day. FDR's boys were on duty in the South Pacific when their father died, and they were unable to get home for the funeral. Jack Kennedy and his brother Joe were in uniform and in harm's way. Others we came to know later, George Bush, Richard Nixon, and Gerald Ford, all Navy officers, later presidents of the United States. Ben Bradley, the most celebrated newspaper editor of his time, was a young naval officer in the Pacific. Johnny Carson, the master of the television medium, looked like a skinny 12-year-old in his naval officer's uniform. Maurice Hank Greenberg ran away from home to join the Army, landed in Normandy on D-Day as a sergeant, and returned to New York to organize the most successful insurance empire in the world. Julia Child, America's favorite woman in the kitchen, was in the OSS. Byron Whizzer White, an All-America football player and Rhodes Scholar, was turned down by the Marines because he was colorblind, but he was accepted for the Naval Intelligence School. He met John Kennedy in the Pacific, and when Kennedy became president, White was his first appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. The themes of war have long been the stuff of great literature, and once World War II ended, a new generation of American writers emerged. Some are still at work today. Norman Mailer, Kurt Vonnegut, William Styron, William Manchester, Paul Fussell, Shelby Foote, and Joseph Heller all served in uniform. World War II and the Civil War, so distinctly different in origin, locale, and time, were nonetheless the common denominators for the young Americans of their time, the defining experiences of the lives of millions of Americans, whatever their status before the first shots were fired. Later accomplishments, however grand or notorious, could not diminish the place of service in the war years. George Bush was a child of privilege when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. His father had accumulated a fortune on Wall Street, and he was a member of the U.S. Senate. Bush's mother presided over a large home in Greenwich, Connecticut, where she sent her children off to the best private schools and camps in chauffeured limousines. But when they returned home, she preached modesty and public responsibility. So it was only natural that on the day he turned 18, George Bush volunteered. He didn't wait for his draft number to be called. His father, the powerful Senator Prescott Bush, didn't attempt to arrange a safe job for his son in the War Department. George volunteered for a relatively new branch of the service, the Navy Air Corps. He wanted to be a combat pilot. By now, after all of his years in public life, his combat experience is well known. There's even a home movie of him being fished from the sea after his plane was shot down during a bombing run on a Japanese target. He rarely talks about his experience personally. He is much more likely to recite his mother's admonition, "Don't brag." When he was running for president, he was asked what he thought about as he drifted in hostile seas after being shot down, and he answered in that endearing but clumsy way of his, "Oh, you know, the usual things. Duty, honor, God, country." As a political answer, it was a groaner. Nevertheless, it was probably very close to the essence of George Bush. For a man who spent so much of his life in the public arena, President Bush was curiously inarticulate about those defining moments. He was battle-scarred in a way the man he served, Ronald Reagan, was not, but next to Reagan, Bush always looked like the younger kid, wide-eyed with hero worship. Even when invited to expand on his thoughts about how World War II shaped him, President Bush is a reluctant witness. Yes, of course, he considers his years as a Navy combat flyer an important experience. He often thinks about the day that he was shot down, but when he does, he's more likely to think about the two buddies who were killed. Could he have done more to save them? When he returned home and plunged into a college education at Yale, sharing very crowded quarters with Barbara and other couples in a New Haven home, hastily converted to an apartment building, Bush didn't look back. He played varsity sports, got his degree, and headed west to the oil fields of Texas and the opportunity they presented. Did combat make him more willing to take those kinds of risks? "I don't believe my combat experience was in any way responsible for my coming to Texas," he reflects now, adding, "The Navy sent us all over, so a move away from a home base was not so traumatic." In that regard, George and Barbara Bush were like many young Americans in their post-war migration to other parts of the country. Kids from the Great Plains who joined the Navy, when they got out, they settled down hard by the sea in California. Young black veterans headed north to a good factory job in Detroit. World War II rearranged more than the political landscape of Europe and Asia. It was a major catalyst for shifting population patterns of the United States in the 50s and 60s. As for business, President Bush agrees that, yes, both military training and experience were helpful to all of us as we tackled various businesses. Maybe, just maybe, he concludes, having taken risks in the service, we were less concerned about taking risks in business. Overall, however, responding to questions about his youthful trials in combat, President Bush likes to invoke what was drummed into him at home even before he enlisted. Honor. As he says, "It was a duty, yes, but truly an honor." He also feels strongly it is an obligation of citizenship that requires no additional reward. "What are we owed?" he asks. "Nothing, not one damn thing." However, it is clear President Bush did gain something personally from the war, that he would not have experienced if he had gone directly to Yale and then on to, say, a career in Wall Street, or even a political career from his home in Connecticut. He saw the other side of life through the eyes and most personal thoughts of his comrades from other classes back home. As an officer on a carrier, even though he was only 19 or 20 at the time, one of Lieutenant Bush's jobs was to read the mail of the enlisted men before it went out so no sensitive military information would be inadvertently compromised. As Bush recalls, "As I did my duty and read the other guy's mail, I learned about life, about true love, about heartbreak, about fear and courage, about the diversity of our great country. The sailors would ask about the harvest, or fishing, or heat in the cities." Bush goes on, "When I would see a man whose letter I had censored, I would look at him differently, look at him with more understanding. I gained an insight into the lives of my shipmates, and I felt richer." As a young man at the controls of a Navy plane, flying off carrier decks, dropping torpedoes on enemy targets, and getting back safely, Bush was a long way from those days of privilege in Greenwich, Connecticut. What he learned went well beyond his own involvement, however. He remembers standing on the carrier deck when another plane made a bad landing. As the pilot tried to take off again, the plane veered out of control, and its propeller cut a deckhand in half. As Bush stood there stunned, staring at a severed leg, a salty chief petty officer rallied the shocked sailors. "God damn it, get back to work. Swab the deck. Clear the deck. Get ready for the next plane." More than 50 years later, that Navy chief stands out in the mind of President Bush as a man who, under great adversity, took charge, rallied the men, got the job done, did his duty. By his own admission, George Bush is not a reflective man. It may have to do with his mother's constant counsel not to draw attention to yourself. Work well done, and a life lived honorably, were reward enough. As a former congressman, ambassador to the United Nations, director of the Central Intelligence Agency, vice president, and then president of the United States, George Bush represents an unequaled record of public service within his generation. He believes he is owed nothing. In fact, he believes World War II was such an overwhelming threat that those who served had an obligation, that they should not expect special treatment forevermore. He believes some veterans organizations are wrong to keep asking for more and more benefits. As he says, "Serving in World War II was an honor, a privilege. I was a tiny part of something noble." Art Buchwald, the lovable teddy bear humorist and columnist, may have been the most unlikely Marine in all of World War II. In his autobiography, Leaving Home, he wrote with endearing candor, "People are constantly amazed when I tell them I was a Marine. For some reason, I don't look like one, and I certainly don't act like one, but I was, and according to God or the tradition of the Corps, I will always be a Marine." Buchwald ran away from a troubled childhood and heartbroken when a summer romance failed. He persuaded a street drunk to sign, as his father, the permission he needed to enlist in the Marines at the age of 17. That he survived basic training on Paris Island was a minor miracle. He was always in a jam for his bumbling ways, terrorized by his drill instructor, Pete Benardi of Elmhurst, Long Island. Buchwald spent the war in the South Pacific attached to a Marine ordnance outfit loading ammunition onto Marine fighter planes that were dueling with Japanese Zeros in the skies over places like Guadalcanal, Okinawa, and Midway. He was on a tiny island called Engebi. Buchwald was not much more competent on Engebi than he had been at Paris Island. Loading a large bomb onto a Marine plane, he hit the wrong lever and dropped it onto the tarmac, sending his buddies scattering, convinced they were about to be blown up. Finally, Buckwald's sergeant assigned him to work on the squad's mimeograph newsletter and to drive a truck, reasoning he wouldn't do much harm to himself or others in those jobs. His sergeant told him later, "You had the ability to screw up a two-car funeral. Anything you touched ceased to function." Buchwald also learned more than he wanted to know about anti-Semitism. Many of the small-town boys he served with had never known a Jew, and they were quick to repeat the bigotry of their upbringing. Buchwald, much more a man of wit and words than fist, nonetheless, found himself in numerous fights after having been called a kike or Christ killer, But then he decided it just wasn't worth all the anger and bruises, so he responded, "Stuff it," and walked away. Now, on reflection, he says, "I can't maintain people picked on me just because I was Jewish. They picked on me because I was an asshole," followed by that familiar Buchwald laugh. Buchwald's life after the war began at the University of Southern California, where he enrolled under the GI Bill, even though he didn't have a high school diploma. In the crush of veterans registering in 1946, the admissions office simply didn't check, and by the time he was found out, Buchwald was a fixture on campus and accepted as a special student. At USC, Buchwald began to hone the gentle, mocking style of humor that would make him one of journalism's best-known columnists and a high-priced public speaker. He wrote for the campus newspaper and a humor magazine. He was friendly on campus with Frank Gifford, the All-America football hero, David Wolper, later one of Hollywood's most successful producers, and Pierre Cossette, the man behind the Grammy Awards on television. It was a fantasy come true for this funny little man from a succession of foster homes in New York. His Walter Mitty life took an even more romantic turn when he learned the GI Bill was good in Paris as well as in the United States. Determined to become another Hemingway or Fitzgerald, Buchwald hitchhiked to New York and caught an old troop ship for France. He lived the life of an expatriate on the modest stipend the GI Bill provided him for registering for classes at the Alliance Française, drinking Pernod late into the night in Montparnasse, stringing for the Daily Variety back in the United States, hanging out with new friends who would later become famous writers, William Styron, Peter Matheson, James Baldwin, Mary McCarthy, Irwin Shaw, Peter Stone. As he recounted in Growing Up, Buchwald loved the life. "We had just come out of the war with great optimism," he said. "It was a glorious period." It became even more glorious when Buchwald talked himself into a job at the International Herald Tribune, the English-language newspaper that was distributed throughout Europe and served as a piece of home for American tourists. In 1949, just 7 years after he'd been rejected by his summertime sweetheart and joined the Marines in a desperate attempt to find a new life, Art Buchwald had talked his way into one of the most glamorous jobs in journalism. Paris After Dark by Art Buchwald quickly became one of the most popular items in the paper, and it led to the byline humor column that made him the best-known American in Paris. He was the city's most popular tourist guide for visiting stars such as Frank Sinatra, Humphrey Bogart, Lauren Bacall, and Audrey Hepburn. His books became bestsellers, and when he came home 16 years later, he was an even bigger star in Washington with his own table at the most popular restaurant in the capital, and lecture fees now at five figures, often with a private plane for transportation. He was practically an uncle to the various Kennedy offspring. When he went to the Redskins games, he sat in the owner's box. He summered on Martha's Vineyard with pals Catherine Graham, Mike Wallace, Bill Styron, and Walter Cronkite. However glamorous his life had become, however, he never forgot he was a Marine. When Colin Powell was preparing to leave the military and enter civilian life, Buchwald offered to advise him on what lecture agencies would serve him best. Powell's assistant called Buchwald, inviting him to lunch with the general at the Pentagon. Buchwald said, "Lunch? Don't I get a parade? I was in the Marine Corps 3.5 years, and I never had a parade." When Buchwald arrived at Powell's office, the general said, "Follow me." He took Buchwald into a large room where Powell had assembled 50 of his staff. As Buchwald entered, they all came to attention and gave him a salute. After all those years of people not believing he had been a Marine, Buchwald had a parade with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs at his side in the Pentagon. He laughs now when he thinks about how much attention he received from the Marine brass once he moved to Washington. "They said I was a great Marine. I was a lousy Marine. But at the last Marine ball I attended, colonels were coming up to have their pictures taken with me. I love that." For Buchwald, it goes well beyond the attention he gets at Marine ceremonies. "I had no father to speak of, no mother. I didn't know what I was doing. Suddenly I'm in the Marines, and it's my family. Someone cared about me. Someone loved me. That's what I still feel today." Despite his lovably rumpled appearance, he also maintains certain habits he learned at Paris Island. He keeps his personal effects neatly arranged, just as he did in his footlocker during basic training. His shoes are always shined to a high gloss. He always has an extra pair of socks, just as the Marines taught him. During the Vietnam War, he was caught between conflicting emotions. He was against that war, yet when the Marine Corps asked him to record some radio commercials for their recruiting efforts, he happily complied. He was flattered, in fact, and after all, he was a Marine. He realized that his old loyalties and his current thinking were in conflict only when friends began to point out the inconsistencies of his behavior. So he stopped recording the Marine commercials. Buchwald has written about his Marine Corps experience so often fellow leathernecks often approach him to compare notes, inevitably saying, "You think your drill instructor was tough? Mine was the toughest in the Corps." Buchwald never concedes. He knows Pete Bernardi was the toughest. In 1965, Life magazine asked Buchwald to return to Parris Island for a week of basic training to recall the old days. He agreed if he could take his old drill instructor, Pete Bernardi. He found Bernardi working as a security guard at the World's Fair in New York and arranged for him to get time off work. Bernardi remembered Buchwald from basic training saying, "I was sure you'd get killed," adding warmly, "You were a real shitbird." In his book, Buchwald recalls they had a nostalgic week at Parris Island and nothing much had changed. He may have been famous, but he was still a klutz. On the obstacle course, Bernardi was still yelling lines like, "25 years ago, I would have hung your testicles from that tree." At the end of the week, they shook hands and parted friends. A quarter century later, Buchwald received a call from a mutual friend telling him Bernardi was gravely ill with cancer. Buchwald telephoned the old drill instructor, whose voice was weak. Bernardi told Buchwald he didn't think he could make this obstacle course. In leaving home, Buchwald describes taking a photo from their Life magazine layout and sending it to Bernardi with the inscription, "To Pete Bernardi, who made a man out of me. I'll never forget you." Bernardi's wife later told Buchwald the old drill instructor put the picture up in his hospital room so everyone could see it and read the inscription. Bernardi also had one final request. That autographed picture from the shitbird, the screw-up Marine he was sure would be killed, little Artie, the guy he called Brooklyn as he tried to make a leatherneck out of him, Corporal Bernardi, the toughest guy Buchwald had ever met, asked that the picture be placed in his casket when he was buried. I confess that I weep almost every time I read that account, for it so encapsulates the bonds within that generation that last a lifetime. In his 1961 inaugural speech, John F. Kennedy said, "Let the word go forth from this time and place to friend and foe alike, that the torch has been passed to a new generation of Americans, born in this century, tempered by war, disciplined by a hard and bitter peace." Given the ambitions of his father and family, John Kennedy's decision to pursue a public life was not wholly altruistic. But in his eloquent inaugural speech, he gave voice to his generation on the issues of peace and war, and also on the importance of entering the arena beyond the battlefield. In the post-war years, politics was a noble calling and a natural extension of the lives of the men and women who had made so many sacrifices and learned so many lessons during the war. Their ideologies and their ambitions spanned a broad spectrum. But they came to the public arena determined to have their say in the future of the country and of the world. Some, such as Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy, a tail gunner in the Army Air Corps during the war, emerged with a dark and twisted view of what was necessary to advance the cause of liberty. Others drew entirely different lessons from their common experience. John Kennedy, the scion of a rich and powerful Boston family, a decorated Navy veteran, ran as a Democrat against Republican Richard Nixon, also a Navy veteran, the son of a poor Quaker family from California. Senators Barry Goldwater and George McGovern were both combat pilots from Western states during the war, and when they landed in the U.S. Senate, they were at opposite ends of the political field. From Eisenhower through George Bush, all but one American president was a veteran of World War II. The exception was Jimmy Carter, a Naval Academy graduate who was commissioned as an officer just as the war ended. From the 50s through the 70s, the halls of Congress were dominated by World War II veterans, senators such as Robert Taft, Mr. Republican, the Ohio pillar of conservatism, was a Navy veteran. A fellow Midwesterner, Senator Paul Douglas of Illinois, a classic liberal, was a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps. Senators Gaylord Nelson of Wisconsin, George McGovern of South Dakota, Edmund Muskie of Maine, Jacob Javits and Pat Moynihan of New York, Warren Magnuson of Washington, George Smathers of Florida, John Tower of Texas, John Glenn of Ohio, Mark Hatfield of Oregon, Frank Church of Idaho. All of them, World War II veterans. They came out of the same war to their political posts, but they were not in lockstep in their ideologies. They had varied views on social, diplomatic, and military questions. They were immediately faced with major challenges in determining how to deal with the Soviet Union, the Cold War, the construct of a formal Western military alliance, China under communism, the great public works projects in America, and the unresolved issue of race. They brought a deeply personal understanding of the consequences of war as an instrument of national policy. After all, they were the young men another generation of old men had sent off to war. Now, they had in their hands those same decisions for another generation of young Americans. Again, they were not always in lockstep. Vietnam deeply divided the country and the World War II generation. The leading hawks and some of the most eloquent doves were from that generation. It was also a cultural schism. Those in political life who publicly supported the war effort while wrestling with private doubts had a visceral antipathy for the long hair, the language, and the flag-burning ways of the anti-war demonstrators. Then, too, they knew that in the working-class neighborhoods and on the farms, there was not the same ratio of deferments and little access to alternative service. No two politicians symbolized the differences with greater clarity than two friends in the U.S. Senate, both members of the Republican Party. Bob Dole of Russell, Kansas, and Mark Hatfield of Salem, Oregon. One, the son of a small-town jack-of-all-trades, the other the son of a railroad blacksmith. One an infantry lieutenant, the other a Navy ensign. The wartime exploits of Bob Dole are well known by now. He was a young lieutenant out of Kansas when he was gravely wounded as he led his squad from the 10th Mountain Division against a fortified German position in the Italian Alps. He almost died before he was evacuated to the United States for a long series of operations and excruciating therapy in what turned out to be the impossible task of completely saving the use of his right arm. The terrible wound came in a flash of enemy fire on an Italian hillside. The recovery took 3 years and 3 months, during which he almost died as a result of infections and other complications. Dole's experience in the war and the sacrifices of his working-class parents and friends in the small, hard-scrabble town of Russell, Kansas, to help him recover from his injuries were appropriately familiar themes in his political career, especially in his campaign for president against Bill Clinton. It was always touching when this complex, proud man, so private and even abrupt when it came to other personal matters, talked about that time in his life. Choking up as he described how his father, with so few means, struggled to make the train trip from Kansas to Chicago to see his badly injured son. How his mother, even though she hated smoking, held his cigarettes for him as he lay in a hospital bed, barely able to move either arm in the early going. How the people of Russell, Kansas set up cigar boxes in businesses along Main Street and labeled them the Bob Dole Fund. They raised $1,800 for his medical fees, mostly through quarters and half dollars. One of his neighbors was as poor as the Doles, but he wanted to do something. So the senator remembers with an affectionate chuckle, "He brought me a duck. Couldn't afford anything else, so he brought me a live duck." It may be difficult for current generations to understand just how much poverty there was across America, even after the war. Working-class families lived right on the margins, with very little left over. They were used to it. It had been that way since the beginning of the 30s, especially in rural America. Indeed, joining the Army was a step up for many after the Depression. Dole remembers, "It was a good deal. You got a good pair of boots, 3 meals a day, new clothing, a new rifle. It was the most many young Americans had ever had." Although Dole has been gone from the neighborhoods and the economic constraints of Russell, Kansas, for a long time now. Those early experiences still shape his attitude. He keeps in his richly appointed Washington, D.C. office a picture of his father dressed in his key brand overalls, pointing out that's what his dad wore to work every day. For all of his power, celebrity, and prosperity, in his emotional makeup, Dole isn't that far removed from his Great Plains roots and formative experiences. The financial deprivations of his childhood, however, were not enough to prepare him for the terrible price he paid in the war. Dole admits he was bitter at times, that he felt sorry for himself. Even now, he occasionally goes back over that fateful day when he was hit. The assault had been delayed for a day because of the death of Franklin Roosevelt, the beloved president who was also commander-in-chief. Dole was greatly saddened by Roosevelt's passing, but he sometimes wonders, what if he hadn't died that day? What if we had moved out on schedule? Would I have been wounded? Once he fully understood that he would never be completely the same again, that he couldn't turn back the clock, he decided to make up for lost time. By his own admission, before the war, he wasn't much of a student. He was a good-time fraternity boy at the University of Kansas. After the war, life was changed forever. He was disabled. He'd spent 5 years either in uniform or in hospitals. He took the GI Bill and headed for the University of Arizona Law School. The government provided him with a left-handed typewriter, a recording machine so he could take notes, and a car with a left-handed shift. As he says now, 50 years later, and an adult lifetime in politics, talk about a generous government. It did not, however, make Dole a champion of government spending programs for other needs that were more social in character. He says the lesson of the GI Bill was that it provided self-reliance for those who had earned the benefits. Dole was not particularly ideological when he was asked by both the Democrats and Republicans in his home county to run for Congress. He was pragmatic, however, figuring the Republicans gave him the best chance of success. So that's where he wound up. He went from the U.S. House of Representatives to the U.S. Senate in 1969. In his maiden speech in the Senate on April 14, 1969, Dole appealed for a presidential commission on people with disabilities. He described the disabled as a group no one joins by personal choice, saying the requirements for membership are not based on age, sex, wealth, education, skin color, political party, power, or prestige. It is an exceptional group, Senator Dole said. I joined on another April 14, 1945. It was the beginning of his personal crusade to make life easier for more than 40 million disabled Americans. By 1990, he had moved the Congress to pass the Americans with Disabilities Act, a sweeping piece of legislation that mandated changes in public buildings, accommodations, and transportation to make it easier for the disabled to function in American society. For Dole, it was his greatest legislative victory, yet it was also a classic example of the two sides of Bob Dole, for it was a federal directive that imposed on states and businesses rigid requirements that were costly and, in some cases, little used. Here was the champion of a reduced role for the federal government and the champion of the disabled in getting a large helping hand from that same federal government, both residing in the office of Senator Bob Dole. On some issues, Dole was much more single-minded. Vietnam was the most taxing time for Dole. He hated the flag-burning, noisy protests, the in-your-face lectures from long-haired students protected from the draft by deferments or influence. As chairman of the Republican National Committee under President Nixon, Dole made some very harsh speeches, all but accusing anti-war protesters and the news media of treason. He's much more mellow now, content to be an elder statesman, but looking back on his political career, he cannot forget those days when anti-war protesters would come to his office or show up at his speeches. This man who endured so much personal pain and whose life was so altered by his time in uniform can now recall thinking during those confrontations with the anti-war activists, why am I sitting here all banged up for this ragtag operation? Is this what America is all about? Then, answering his own question, he says in that cryptic Dole style, I guess that's what it is all about, freedom. But sometimes it's a stretch. I remember being glad when they were gone. Besides, kids are better now. As a product of his time and a proud but private man, Dole was an anachronistic candidate for president in the last election before the turn of the century. He seemed to be playing by old rules and values as he made his way across the country, raising questions about Bill Clinton's facile form of government by asking, "Where is the outrage?" He invoked his World War II experience and the lessons of his wounds repeatedly, but they were lessons lost on a new generation of voters who were barely aware of Vietnam. The earlier flashes of dark rays that characterized his early years on the national stage were gone, but the sharp humor remained, one of Dole's most endearing characteristics. It was Dole, after all, who once remarked that America had three living ex-presidents, Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford, and Richard Nixon. Without missing a beat, he went on, "Speak no evil, hear no evil, and evil." But as a man who wanted the presidency for himself, he simply could not win the hearts and minds of enough American voters. In his campaign, however, there were the moments that gave him a lift. He'd be on a stage somewhere preparing to give another speech, another stop in a long campaign that simply could not get traction. He'd look out into the audience and lock eyes with a white-haired man, or a group of them, in their American Legion or veterans of foreign war caps, sometimes in windbreakers with their military units spelled out. They would nod quietly to each other, the candidate and the men of his generation who had been to war and back. It was a silent ritual played out hundreds of times across America, a valedictory salute of a generation to one of its own. Bob Dole, the man from Russell, Kansas, who grew up in the basement of his family home so his parents could rent out the upstairs, is now a prosperous elder statesman in Washington, often cited as a prospective intermediary in vexing political problems. He's undertaken special presidential missions to Bosnia and Kosovo. He's also commander of a national campaign to build a World War II memorial in Washington, D.C. The $100 million fundraising drive became the primary focus of his life following his loss to Bill Clinton in the 1996 presidential election. President Clinton unveiled the design for the memorial on the same day he awarded Dole the Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian award. Typically, Dole had equipped for the occasion, saying he had hoped to be there that day to accept the key to the front door. Then, as he has in recent years, he became emotional as he talked about the meaning of World War II. Dole believes the memorial, which is to be located at the Washington Monument end of the reflecting pool in the Capitol, is necessary to remind the world that just men and women can prevail. He wants it to be a backdrop for World War II's realized ideals, a platform for America's children to speak out for freedom, decency, and human democracy. In his White House remarks that day, Dole was particularly eloquent. He said, "I've seen American soldiers bring hope and leave graves in every corner of the world. I've seen this nation overcome depression and segregation and communism, turning back mortal threats to human freedom." He was describing his own life and the monumental legacy of his generation in a few well-crafted words. It was just a moment in the life of this complicated man from the Kansas prairie, his right arm dangling at his side, those dark and flashing eyes muted by emotion. But it was a moment to savor, for it represented the many sides of Bob Dole. Public servant, wounded veteran, proud patriot, elder statesman. Senator Mark Hatfield of Oregon is a politician whose central political philosophy was defined by the interlocking experience he had as a young man raised in a strongly religious family and what he saw as a Navy ensign in the Pacific, particularly at Hiroshima. Consequently, he was always a unique member of the Republican Party in the U.S. Congress. While other members of the GOP were aggressive defenders of the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, he was an early critic of that war. He also voted against his own Republican presidents, Reagan and Bush, when they sent American troops to Grenada and the Persian Gulf. Hatfield, a teetotaler and a devout member of the Baptist Church, also split from his party on the issue of gun control and the death penalty, although he did support the anti-abortion views of the vast majority of his fellow Republicans. Despite the differences on some of the major litmus tests of the GOP, Hatfield's place in Oregon politics was always secure. Hatfield was a freshman at Willamette University in Salem, Oregon, when Pearl Harbor was attacked. He immediately joined the Naval Reserve and accelerated his studies so he could be in training by the winter of 1943. He remembers it as a jolt to go from the mild winters of the Pacific Northwest to upstate New York to become first a midshipman and then an ensign assigned to amphibious landing craft duty. After additional training in California and Hawaii, Hatfield participated in the invasions of Iwo Jima and Okinawa, two of the most critical and costly battles of the war in the Pacific. As is often the case with veterans of combat, he remembers the comical and the tragic equally well. Recalling the landings at Iwo Jima, he says, "Our boat was taking on water and we had to bail. We had two buckets. The first bucket load, they threw the bucket overboard with the water, and we had a big laugh. But it wasn't going to work with that bucket down in the water, so it just came to me, take off your helmets and use them and hang on to them. It broke the tension and gave everyone an opportunity to laugh." There weren't many other laughs on Iwo Jima, or in Ensign Hatfield's experience there, however. He was too busy making the runs from the mothership to shore with fresh Marines and returning with wounded Marines. The Navy maps failed to show the approach to the landing zone was a steeply pitched beach, so many of the larger vessels were partially sunk or partially wrecked. That made maneuvering the small landing craft a tedious and even more hazardous affair. It was a dangerous assignment that Hatfield repeated again and again, always aware that he could be killed at any moment. But like so many his age and in these conditions, he had what he remembers as a certain feeling of fatalism. There is nothing you can do about it. You become oblivious to the death and wounds all around you. You become a detached person, viewing it from a distance, even though it is going on right at your feet. There was something else for Hatfield, his faith. "I was raised in a very strong Christian home," he says. "I suppose that was also part of my armor, in the sense if I got hit, I knew where I was headed. I had confidence in my faith." Hatfield was on the beach at Iwo Jima the day one of the most symbolic acts of World War II occurred. He remembers one of the guys said, "Hey, look, at the top of the rock, Suribachi, we saw the American flag being raised. It was a thrilling moment. When we saw that flag go up, it really did give us a sense of victory, even though we still fought on for some time." The future senator from Oregon had a close-up look at other momentous occasions in the Pacific War. After participating in the Okinawa invasion, his unit was sent to the Philippines to prepare for the invasion of Japan. When the U.S. dropped the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, forcing Japan to surrender, Hatfield suddenly had an altogether different assignment. He was part of the fleet that accompanied Douglas MacArthur into Japan to begin the occupation. "We sailed by the USS Missouri as the Japanese diplomats were going aboard to sign the terms of surrender. Quite a moment." MacArthur had instructed the Japanese to place a white sheet in front of every gun emplacement. "So when we were coming into Tokyo Bay, it was like a checkerboard on all sides of us. We would have been caught in a murderous crossfire in the invasion. It would have been terrible, terrible invading Japan," Hatfield concludes. In September 1945, Hatfield had a one-day experience that would affect his life and his political behavior forever. "I was part of a crew of people that went into Hiroshima," he says. "This was about a month after the bomb had been dropped. There was a smell to the city, and total silence. It was amazing to see the utter and indiscriminate devastation in every direction, and to think just one bomb had done it. We had no comprehension of the power of that bomb until then." Hatfield says as the American party sailed into the canals, Japanese parents and their children watched silently. "When we landed, the little kids saw we weren't going to kill or shoot them, so they began to gather around. We realized they were very hungry, so we took our lunches and broke them up and gave them to as many kids as we could." In that moment, Hatfield learned something about hate that stays with him to this day. "You learn to hate with a passion in wartime," he says. "If you don't kill your enemy, they kill you. But sharing those sandwiches with the people who had been my enemy was sort of a therapy for me. I could almost feel my hate leaving me. It was almost a spiritual experience." When he made his way to the U.S. Senate, Hatfield brought with him not only what he calls an unshakable anti-nuke philosophy, but also a first-hand understanding of what motivated Ho Chi Minh and his forces. In addition to seeing the flag raised on Iwo Jima, the USS Missouri when the surrender ceremonies were getting underway, and the devastation of Hiroshima, Hatfield was one of the few Americans to see a future battleground, Vietnam. He says, "We were sent to Haiphong to pick up Chinese nationalist troops and transport them to northern China where they would fight the communist forces of Mao Zedong." In Vietnam, Hatfield visited Hanoi, where Ho Chi Minh, who had been an American ally against the Japanese, was organizing his forces for independence. Seeing the terrible misery imposed on the Vietnamese people by the French affected my position on the Vietnam War from the very beginning, Hatfield says. I never could buy the idea that America somehow had a national interest out there or was threatened. Hatfield became one of the most persistent and articulate opponents of the Vietnam War as soon as he was in the Senate, often joined by his fellow World War II veteran, Senator George McGovern of South Dakota, another product of a religious family who had learned to abhor war during his heroic service in the Army Air Corps. They were among the earliest congressional critics of the war, often mocked by conservative voices as being somehow soft on the question of how to face down communism. McGovern, at least, had support within his own party. Hatfield was often alone within the GOP ranks, but it did not deter him. Simultaneously, he devoted a good deal of his energies to checking the growth of nuclear weapons and power. "I was persuaded," he says, "that the genie was out of the bottle, but somehow we had to try to put it back in. I devoted myself to stopping underground nuclear tests and controlling the military spending on nuclear weapons. Also, I was opposed to the use of nuclear power for electricity. That, to me, is the greatest environmental problem we have." Through the years, Hatfield remained a consistent foe of nuclear weapons and war in general. In addition to his persistent stand against Vietnam, one of the reasons he wound up on President Nixon's infamous enemies list, Hatfield also opposed Ronald Reagan's invasion of the tiny Caribbean island of Grenada. He was even more aroused about President Bush's plan to go to war in the Persian Gulf. He says, "Well, I couldn't believe the American people approved the war in the Gulf. To me, it was nothing but an oil war." Hatfield was one of just two Republicans to vote against approving Operation Desert Storm. As time went on, Senator Hatfield was increasingly isolated within his own party, and not just because of his views on war and nuclear power. He also cast the vote that defeated the proposed amendment to the Constitution to require a balanced federal budget. At the time, he was chairman of the mighty Senate Appropriations Committee, so it was a powerful statement and unacceptable to the class of aggressively conservative younger Republicans who had been elected to the Senate in the Reagan Revolution. They wanted to strip him of his chairmanship or find some other way to punish him. Hatfield stood his ground and won the day, winning praise primarily from older senators who recognized the days of individual courage in their chamber are rare anymore. But Hatfield also knew it was time to go after four terms in the Senate. In his last election, his margin of victory had fallen after an embarrassing and surprising development. St. Mark, as he is sometimes called, had been formally rebuked by the Senate Ethics Committee for not reporting gifts and loans from friends and lobbyists. Now he was plainly much more out of step with his party on the issues that define the GOP agenda in the 90s. So in 1996, Mark Hatfield retired and returned to his beloved Oregon to teach and share in the benefits that he had brought to his state during the 30 years in the Senate. He left as he arrived, a man of strong, independent convictions, and still a member of the Republican Party, despite the changes in the DNA of the GOP in recent years. Commenting on the Republican newcomers, Hatfield told a reporter, "There are those who think we should be of one mind. They feel, perhaps, that diversity in the party is a weakness, not a strength. I'm an old guard Republican. The founders of our party were for small business, education, cutting the military budget. That was our platform in 1856, and I still think it's a darn good one." Some of the newer Republican senators, with their strict conservative dogma, may never understand a man like Mark Hatfield. but then they've never shuttled Marines ashore under heavy fire at Iwo Jima or Okinawa. They've never looked out on the unworldly landscape of nuclear devastation and shared their lunch with a Japanese child. As an impressionistic adolescent in the post-war years, I spent hours going through Bill Mauldin's book, Up Front, the brilliant collection of his drawings and thoughts on the enlisted men, the officers, army rules, the people they liberated, and the enemy they fought in World War II. He was just 22 years old when his representations of the American fighting men, Willie and Joe, appeared. Infantrymen were called dog faces, and in his work, Mauldin shared with those on the front lines, as well as those at home, the hard truths and dark humor of life at war. As so often is the case with a cartoon, Mauldin gave us the quick laugh and the lingering insight. Recently, I read Up Front again. I was initially pleased by how many of the cartoon captions I could recite from memory. His work leaves a lasting impression. When I began to read the text, I had an even deeper appreciation of Mauldin's boy genius. He put the book together near the end of the war when he was just 23. By then he was a sergeant, having entered the Army from the Arizona National Guard when he was 18. I can't imagine anyone knew the mind, the frustrations, the fears, and the dreams of the average combat infantryman better than Bill Mauldin. As his cartoons reflected the truth of what it was like to be up front, his writing gave us a vision of the future. Here is what Mauldin wrote of the American soldier before the war ended. They are very different now. Don't let anybody tell you they aren't. You can't pay in money for what they have done. They need people telling about them so they will be taken back into their civilian lives and given a chance to be themselves again. There will be some good ones and some bad ones, but the vast majority of combat men are going to be no problem at all. They are so goddamn sick and tired of having their noses rubbed in the stinking war that their only ambition will be to forget it. They don't need pity, because you don't pity brave men, men who are brave because they fight while they are scared to death. Mauldin had it precisely right. He wrote that more than a half century ago, before the men headed home from the front lines. And it is as true today as it was then. They didn't want pity, and they did want to forget. Of course, they could not forget, especially those in combat. When they couldn't erase the war from memory, they simply confined it there, refusing to talk about it unless questioned, and then only reluctantly. That is why it is so important for us to hear these stories now, to know what an exceptional time that was for so many, and how much they sacrificed to give us the world we have today. As for me, I will always keep in my mind's eye a cool, cloudy Memorial Day on the northern plains of South Dakota. I was visiting my father's surviving brother, John, who, after serving in the Navy during World War II, returned to the small town of Bristol, the Brokaw family seat. He stayed a bachelor all those years, working at the bank and in the municipal liquor store. He was a small, quiet man, and on that Memorial Day, he asked me to accompany him to the cemetery south of town, overlooking the broad reach of prairie. He explained that just the year before, he had given up the job of placing small flags in the graves of veterans. He was worried his successor, a veteran of the Korean War, might not know all the graves that deserved to be honored. So, as I watched, these two veterans, each clutching a fistful of small American flags, made their way through the town cemetery. It came to me then that this was, in many ways, the essence of the American experience. These two men who had gone off to war in distant places returned to the familiar surroundings of their youth, the small town and farmland where life was often difficult as a result of droughts, blizzards, tornadoes, and wages that reflected the uncertainty of agricultural markets. They came home to continue the lives and the freedom they had gone off to defend. On this day, they were quietly honoring those who had joined them in the calling. I have been witness to historic events at the U.S. Capitol and on the South Lawn of the White House, at Arlington National Cemetery and the Statue of Liberty. None moved me more than the sight of my uncle and his friend, a local farmer, decorating the graves of the hometown veterans on that Memorial Day. The veterans whose graves would be decorated would carry the colors for the others who lay beneath that prairie sod. their families and friends who had helped tame the prairie and settle the communities. Their greatest legacy is in their lives of dedication and service and honor and duty to country. They have heard the speeches. They've seen the fireworks. They've marched in the parades. They will have their World War II memorial, but no block of granite, no edifice, however elaborate, can match their individual and collective contributions. As this nation moves into a new century, it has no greater obligation than to honor this generation. We should do no less, and so much more.
This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.